This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Many of us have heard of the Humboldt Penguin or the Humboldt Current, maybe even Humboldt Peak in Colorado. Numerous places bear the name. The state of Nevada was almost called Humboldt. But chances are many of us don't know of the man, Alexander von Humboldt. Turns out he was a prolific explorer, scientist, author, and observer whose work influenced Henry David Thoreau, William Wordsworth, and Thomas Jefferson, to name just a few. Our guest this hour says Humboldt revolutionized the way we see the natural world by viewing it as an interconnected web of life. Andrea Wolf is author of The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World, and she joins us in studio. Andrea, welcome to Radio Times, or I should say welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
So you describe Humboldt as arguably the last great polymath. Give us a character sketch, if you would.
So he was born in 1769, which is the same year as Napoleon. He was the son of wealthy Prussian parents, aristocratic, who lived in Berlin. He dies in 1859, so he's just a few months before his 90th birthday. So he, you know, lives a very, very long life. He was a visionary thinker and scientist. He was actually the most celebrated scientist of his age, although he's completely forgotten today in the English-speaking world. His contemporaries thought that he was the most famous man after Napoleon. Mm. They called him the Shakespeare of the sciences. So he's this extraordinary character who, I've kind of made it my mission to kind of make him known again.
And he was a character. He was a fast talker. He was a live wire, wasn't he?
I don't think I've ever encountered a historical person who's been so, you know, restless. When you look at his manuscripts, for example, he kind of starts conventionally enough. He just writes down his ideas and then he scribbles something in the corners. And then he starts tearing out pages and scribbles on more and glues them all on top of each other. So it becomes this multi-layered collage of his thoughts. And you just think, how can he work like this? But he himself said that he was driven as if I'm chased by 10,000 pigs. So he has this incredible drive, which I think is the reason why he, you know, was an explorer. So he went for 5 years to Latin America. But then as a 60-year-old, he went to Russia and covered 10,000 miles in 6 months. Mm-hmm. So not what your average 60-year-old would do.
No, especially at that time. We're going to get into the story of his journey. Let's start at the beginning. As you indicated, he was born into a life of privilege to a wealthy Prussian family. But he chose to leave that. Was that a tough decision for him?
No, I don't think so. He was incredibly curious already as a young man. There's a wonderful anecdote where Frederick the Great, the Prussian king, asked the young Alexander von Humboldt if he intended to conquer the world like his namesake, Alexander the Great, to which Humboldt said, "Yes, sir, but with my head." So, and that's exactly what he did. He was incredibly curious, and his father died when he was very young, and his mother was very emotionally cold. So she provided an excellent education, but Humboldt never really got on with her. And he wanted to travel and go on a voyage for a long time, but she wanted him to be a civil servant in Prussia. So when she dies in 1796, he's delighted, basically, because he inherits a lot of money and he can finally leave because he finds Prussia kind of very narrow-minded and constricting.
It was that the culture at the time that you did not leave? You took care of a parent until they died?
Well, it's not so much taking care of your parents. It's more like you had to, you know, your parents were giving you the money, so you couldn't really rebel against them. He was in that sense a good son. He did what was asked of him. And he just couldn't wait to, you know, get away. And he hated Berlin. I mean, until he dies, he hated Berlin.
So why did he want to go to South America?
Well, he claimed that his love for wanting to go to South America came actually through a visit to the Botanical Garden in Berlin, where he saw the tropical species. So he wanted to see these kind of very exotic landscapes.
So he inherits some money after his mother's death, and then along with a fellow scientist and traveling companion, is it
Aimé Bonpland?
Bonpland. They head to the Spanish territories in South America. Where did he first land and what did he see?
So they left Europe in June 1799 and they went to what's now Venezuela. And they're wonderful descriptions when they arrive, where they say, like, we're going mad. You know, they see so much stuff and he doesn't know where to turn and what to pick up. And they're running out of paper to press the plants on, and they're, you know, running out of space in their trunks. They're just so excited because this is a completely different world to what he's used. And then they go on this incredible journey along the Orinoco and the surrounding river networks, which is, you know, it's a very, very dangerous journey they make. They paddle 1,400 miles along the rivers, 75 grueling days deep in the rainforest. They encounter jaguars and crocodiles and snakes. Their boat capsizes. They almost starve. But they also encounter the rainforest, which is the most magnificent ecosystem on the planet.
As a scientist, what is his overall goal? Again, could you characterize that? He's going down there with this embarrassment of riches of science. And what is he trying to do?
What he sets out to do right from the beginning is to look at nature as a whole. He is not interested, and that's why he's, you know, he's a polymath. He's not going there as a botanist or as a geologist or as a zoologist. He goes there with all these different interests, and he looks at nature as one rather than just pursuing plants or just pursuing animals. So he actually begins to look at animals within their habitat. He takes temperatures. He takes, you know, the humidity. He kind of looks at all the different factors of climate and of vegetation. And that's what makes him such an, you know, extraordinary scientist in the end.
Yeah, how did he come to that point of view, looking at nature as a whole? Because that was not the prevailing way to look at nature at that time.
Well, I think the prevailing view at that time is to really look at nature through the lens of classification. So it's kind of a very narrow approach to nature. And I think it's because he is such a genius polymath. He's not interested in just one thing. He wants to look at everything together. And the more he sees in South America, the more he realizes that everything is interconnected. And it's something that, you know, finally clarifies when he goes to the Andes and kind of sees everything there. But he is...
When one piece is removed, then the rest suffers.
Yeah. So he comes up with this concept of nature as a web of life. So it's this tapestry of nature. And he realizes that if you pull one thread, the whole thing might unravel. So that's why he's also the first person to predict harmful human-induced climate change.
Because, I'd like to get into that.
Yeah.
That was two centuries ago, as we mentioned. He warned, mankind's mischief disturbs nature's order. Am I correct in that his observations about climate change were around the colonial plantations at, was it Lake Valencia in Venezuela?
Yes.
Could you get into that for us?
Yes. So what he's doing is, because he's observing everything, because he's observing nature as a connected whole, he tries to understand what's happening. So when they go to this very wealthy agricultural region in northern Venezuela around Lake Valencia, he sees how the forest has kind of basically disappeared there. The trees had been felled to make way for cash crops. And he realizes that heavy rains had kind of washed off the good topsoil. He realized that the water levels of the lake were falling because the farmers had diverted water to irrigate their fields. So he starts to kind of think, and he is the very first there to say, to explain the fundamental functions of the forest for the ecosystem and the climate. So he's the very first to say a forest can store water, a tree can store water, a forest has cooling effect, a forest can enrich atmosphere with moisture and protect against soil erosion. So all of that happens there, and then amazingly, a few years later, he says there are three ways in which humankind is affecting the climate. One is deforestation, one is irrigation, and one is gas emissions at the industrial centers. Mm. And he says that in 1832. So it's just, I mean, it's just mind-blowing if you think about it.
And Andrea Wolf, did anybody pay attention?
Well, interestingly, there is a very famous American who pays attention, a man called James Madison, who is the fourth president of the United States. So when, because Humboldt visits the United States and he meets Madison and Jefferson, and Madison, as I've argued in my previous book, The Founding Gardeners, is really the forgotten father of American environmentalism. But all his ideas come from that visit with Humboldt, because Humboldt arrives here buzzing with ideas from Latin America, you know, about this, these new ideas about nature and, you know, nature as an ecosystem, really, although he doesn't use the word ecosystem. So there is some influence here.
You write that in the 18th century, it was believed that humankind would make nature better through cultivation. How so?
So this is, I mean, this is a time when neat fields, for example, are seen as the epitome of beauty, when the untamed forest is seen as a hostile environment. So cultivation, orchards, fields, gardens, all that is, you know, cultivating nature, that's the good thing, you know, subjugating nature, not what, I mean, the wilderness at that time is really not seen as something good.
And as far as interconnectedness is concerned, he not only looks at what he sees in South America, but he extends that to Europe. What did he find in Europe and South America that were comparable?
So he basically, he goes from Venezuela, he goes to Cuba, and then he goes back to South America, and he travels from the northern coast of what's today Colombia all the way to Lima, 2,500 miles through the Andes. Now, as he crosses the Andes, he climbs every reachable volcano. And as he does that, he sees, because a lot of those volcanoes are very close to the equator, for him, the journey from the valley up to the peaks of these volcanoes are almost like a botanical journey from the equator to the pole. So that he sees the tropical species in the valley, such as banana trees and palm trees. And then the further up he goes, the vegetation changes up to the snow line where he sees lichen. And he suddenly realizes while he does that, that a lot of the plants he sees on the lower slopes are similar to plants he has seen in the Alps in Switzerland, in the Pyrenees in Spain, and in Tenerife. And he suddenly realizes that there's this resemblance of plants across continents, which no one has really kind of thought of before.
And we'll talk more about that trip in just a moment on Radio Times. We're examining the life of Alexander von Humboldt, a naturalist who lived in the 18th and 19th centuries, who revolutionized the way the scientific world looks at nature. Our guest is Andrea Wolf, author of The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And as always, we welcome your calls, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More in a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And Andrea Wolf is our guest this hour. She's written about the life of an extraordinary explorer and scientist of the 18th and 19th centuries, Alexander von Humboldt. Her book is The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Email is radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Andrea, we were talking about von Humboldt's trips through the Andes and the volcanoes. And I'd like to get into just for a moment how difficult these trips were. We're talking about what, right around the turn of the 19th century. So there was not the equipment for altitude sickness. And you also mentioned he was carrying all his instruments. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
So Humboldt was obsessed with measurement, and he went to Latin America with 42 scientific instruments, all, you know, individually packed in velvet-lined boxes. And he kind of schleps them, you know, everywhere. And now I followed his footsteps through Latin America. I mean, not everywhere, because I didn't have 5 years, obviously, but I went... I went to Ecuador and did some of the climbed some of the volcanoes there. And I have to say, like, with every single step I took up the kind of barren mountain lobes, my admiration for Humboldt kind of grew, because I had, you know, very good walking boots. I didn't have to carry anything. And I, you know, it's hard. You just struggle so much. So I went, for example, to Chimborazo, which was then believed to be the highest mountain in the world. It was just under 21,000 feet. I made it to 16,400 feet, but he went up to almost 20,000 feet. And there's this, so it's a volcano that becomes elemental in his vision of nature. And he climbs up, and he describes it. And there's this description where he and his three traveling companions are crawling on hands and knees on this kind of really high, narrow ledge. And they're struggling to breathe in the thin air. The icy wind has kind of numbed their hands and feet. Their gums are bleeding. Their eyes are bloodshot. Their soles of the shoes are shredded, so their feet begin to bleed. And it's just extraordinary. And every few hundred yards, he will stop. He'll set up his scientific instruments. He'll measure, like, gravity, humidity, the blueness of the sky, and then he'll continue.
We know he's a driven person from what you've told us. I'm wondering how he got the rest of the crew to go with him. Or did he drop people along the way?
Well, so Aimé Bonpland was very adventurous himself too. And I think they made a very good team, because Bonpland was really driven, but he was a very calm person. And Humboldt was this kind of slightly frantic person. So I think they kind of worked very well together. They had an Indian servant called Jose, who Humboldt employed in Venezuela, who traveled with them throughout Latin America. And his main job was to carry the travel barometer, because that was the most important instrument. And, for example, on the on Chimborazo, they had a couple of people who helped carrying the instruments, but they stopped at the snow line. They refused to go any further. So when they continue, there's this moment at the beginning, Chimborazo is kind of hidden in thick fog, and then there's this moment when the fog lifts and they can suddenly see the peak, you know, the snow capped peak against the blue sky. But they also see there's a huge crevasse in front of them, and they can't go any further. They're about 1,000 feet below the peak. So they stop there, but no one has ever been so high. So he and Bonpland and José hold the world record for several decades. So no one had ever been higher. And he's standing there, and he's kind of looking down on Earth, really. So, and he, and suddenly everything clarifies for him, that everything hangs together. You know, that it's a bit like, I suppose, the Apollo mission, when they first see Earth rise. You know, that is really the beginning of kind of modern environmental movement, where we, you know, where people saw, like, we are all together on this little small Earth. And this moment on Chimborazo is, I think, very similar. We can kind of compare that. It's this moment where he can see, you know, further than anyone else before.
So, Andrea, just as a quick aside, what was your impression of Chimborazo when you were there?
Oh, it's one of the best moments of my life, I have to say. I went with my very, very best friend, who's been my best friend since I've been 4. And this was a kind of, like, you know, once-in-a-lifetime voyage, really. And it took forever, and every step is it's so laden, it's so hard, the thin air, and, you know, it gets so much harder the further up you go. And but sitting there, and you're above the clouds, and you look and I suddenly realized that I've only ever been this high in a plane. You know, I've never been on Earth this high. So it was an incredible moment. And I had another wonderful moment when I went up the Antisana, which is another volcano, where we found, at 13,000 feet, we found the hut in which Humboldt had spent one night. And at that moment, there were 4 condors circling above me, and a herd of wild horses suddenly turned up. So that was a pretty spectacular moment, too.
Let's get back to Chimborazo for a moment, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce this, but this was really the muse, if you would, for one of his most impressive works. Maybe I will try to pronounce it. Is it Natürlicher Müller?
almost Naturgemälde.
Not close.
What he does is this. He is the very first scientist to use a form of graphic visualization of data, which, you know, we are totally used to today. And what he does is it's a painting. So Naturgemälde is a German, kind of untranslatable German word. It really means a kind of painting of nature, but in German there's a slightly more philosophical content to it. He calls it also his microcosm on a page. And what it is it's a cross-section of the mountain on which he paints or draws, writes, all the names of all the plants he finds according to their altitude. And then to the left and to the right, he provides, there are like 20 columns in which he provides data such as the measurements he did, like the chemical components of the air, the blueness of the sky, the gravity, all according to the altitude of the mountain. So you can, if you look at one column, you can kind of move over to the cross-section of the mountain and you see these are the plants that they are growing there. This is how, you know, the air pressure is at that height. And then he gives a column with all the different heights of different mountains across the world. So in one glimpse, you can actually see all the information. And one of the reasons is because he was really keen that science should be accessible and popular for everybody. So this was a way to make it very clear and very obvious. He also invents something which are called isotherms, which are the wavy lines we see today on weather maps.
Sure.
And again, that's a way of, you know, we think it's totally normal today, but it was an extraordinary achievement, really, because before you had all these like tables of temperature, you know, in, say, Quito, Berlin, Washington, but no one could compare it. And he gave us a map of the world where he linked all the cities, the places that had the same temperatures. And suddenly you could see there were these belts which go across the globes, which are climate zones. And he did the same with plants, vegetation zones.
So did these works finally grab the attention of the scientific world?
Yes. I mean, he's the first, and it really becomes, after that, a lot of scientists begin to using data in a kind of visual way.
We've got telephone calls. John in Westchester, a welcome to Radio Times. How are you, John?
Hello.
Hello.
Very good. Interested in the show because years ago I did, when I was in college, I did research on the men who founded the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. And they were very interested and had a lot of praise for von Humboldt. But when it came to like issues of slavery or whether Europeans should colonize native peoples, they tended to say, yes, Europeans should be doing this. And von Humboldt it struck me that he was very, he was very progressive. There's a quote he had where he said something like, all people have the same capacity to enjoy liberty or something like that.
He was an abolitionist, wasn't he?
Yes, yes.
Thank you, John.
He was. And and I think that's one of the other extraordinary things about Humboldt. It's like wherever you look, he has his fingers in the pie. So he's very outspoken against slavery. It's one of the big problems he actually has with the United States. He loves the United States, but he remains very critical about slavery. And whenever he has a visitor from North America in Europe, he will ask them about what's going on. And he is very vocal about his criticism of slavery in South America, also how the indigenous people are treated. And he actually says that all the bad things that happens in the colonies is because of Europeans, is because of European greed and vice. He is also the one who is very influential on Simon Bolivar. So they talk about how the colonists are treated in South America. So he's incredibly outspoken. And there's a fascinating little episode where one of his books, which is about Cuba, really, is published as an English translation in the United States. And the publisher leaves out the chapter where Humboldt criticizes slavery. Hmm. And Humboldt is furious. So he writes these letters to all the important American newspapers announcing that this translation is basically rubbish and that it's not what he was saying, and that the most important part, his criticism of slavery, has been deleted, and therefore he can't, you know, support this translation.
Humboldt does visit Philadelphia. He does want to visit with Thomas Jefferson. How do these conversations regarding slavery go with Jefferson?
I think it's one of the subjects they avoided. Basically, you have to imagine this. So Humboldt arrives here in at the end of May 1804. He has just, so it's on his return journey from Latin America to Europe, and he's meeting the president of the United States. So at that time, Humboldt is, you know, known because newspapers have written about his exploration, but he's not world famous yet. And he's meeting Jefferson, and he just writes him a letter. He's like, hey, you know, hello, Mr. President, I really want to meet you. And Jefferson is very keen to meet Humboldt. And one of the reasons is that the timing was pretty perfect because Jefferson had just acquired the Louisiana Territory the previous year for the United States. So there was Humboldt, who had been in Mexico, coming back with all this information that Jefferson could get nowhere else. And Humboldt very happily unpacked his notebooks and his maps and kind of briefed the president of the United States about their new neighbor, Mexico. So that was their main kind of subject. They did not talk about slavery, although Humboldt did write a letter when he's leaving here to William Thornton, who was the architect in Washington, but who's also a close friend of Jefferson. And in that letter, he criticizes slavery very outspokenly. So I think he didn't quite dare mentioning it to Jefferson at that point.
Okay, let's get to another telephone call. Hal in Center City, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, Hal.
Yeah, hi. Until recently, or it may still be in existence there, was or still is a gay naturalist society in Philadelphia named the Humboldt Society, named after Humboldt, on the evidence that Humboldt and his partner in exploration were lovers and that Humboldt was gay. I'd like that to be mentioned.
Hal, thanks for the call. He's a handsome man.
He definitely did not have an affair with Aimé Bonpland. He makes that very clear. I also believe that Humboldt was gay, but not Bonpland was not his partner. He had very intense relationships with other young scientists, and people were talking about it. I think it was kind of like an open secret. But he's also someone who says, you know, I don't really have sensual needs. And I think he uses a lot of the kind of physical exertion, the kind of physical climbing, exploration, all of that. He uses that as a distraction also, I think.
Let's get to some of the people that Humboldt influenced. William Wordsworth used Humboldt's travel account, Personal Narrative, as a source material for his sonnets.
Yes, a lot of the romantic poets adored Humboldt's nature writing because Humboldt really comes up with a very new style in writing about nature. It's really the blueprint of all nature writing today because he combines evocative landscapes descriptions with scientific observations. So Wordsworth, for example, there is one stanza in one of his poems where he takes almost word for word a description that Humboldt gives about something at the Orinoco, and he just turns it into verse. I mean, it's just extraordinary when you see it kind of next to each other. Coleridge was influenced by him. And then here in America, you have Henry David Thoreau.
I was just going to say, what's the connection there?
So I would argue, actually, that Walden would be a very, very different book without Humboldt.
Really?
So basically what happens is, in 1847, Thoreau leaves his cabin at Walden Pond, and he begins to write what will become Walden. But he struggles, and he writes his manuscripts, he rewrites it, he redrafts it, and he just can't get on with it, and he just finally puts it away. And one of the problems he has is that he's torn between poetry and science, and he can't really find the balance, and he's really frustrated. And then he picks up Humboldt's book, Cosmos, in which Humboldt really combines this idea that you have to use your imagination to understand nature, but you also have to measure nature. So he is not just an enlightenment scientist. He's also someone who says we have to feel nature to understand it. So Thoreau reads that, and it's this revelation, and it's really the answer to his dilemma, how to be a poet and a scientist. And he reads it, and he takes out his manuscripts, and he rewrites Walden.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Who knew? He's everywhere. So why do we not know of him widely in America?
I think there are several reasons. So he is – I think it's almost like his ideas have become so – we take them for granted so much. We've almost kind of absorbed them by osmosis that we have forgotten the man behind it. It's also because it's not just one discovery. He comes up with a worldview. So
that, and yet in Europe, he's well known.
He's well known. And in South America, he's really well known. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I think he's forgotten in the English-speaking world is also because he was famous here until World War One, and then the anti-German sentiment is just so strong that, you know, in England, for example, the royal family, they changed their surname to Windsor because, you know, the other surname sounded too German. You have libraries here, public libraries in America, burning German books. It's really not a time anymore to celebrate a German scientist at that time. So that's one of the other reasons. And I think another reason is that he was a polymath. And he dies in 1859, which is really a time when the science has become so specialized that these expert scientists are now looking down on people who kind of dabble in all the different disciplines.
Our guest is Andrea Wolf, author of The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. We are examining the life of this naturalist and polymath here on Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Back in just a bit. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And Andrea Wolf is our guest this hour. She's written about the life of an extraordinary explorer and scientist of the 18th and 19th centuries, and that is Alexander von Humboldt. Her book is The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, here is the number, 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are continuing with von Humboldt's his journey. He heads to Paris. Is that after South America he goes back to Paris?
So he goes South America, Philadelphia, Washington, Philadelphia, Europe.
Okay. So why Paris instead of home?
Paris at that time is so deeply steeped in the sciences as no other European city. So this is really the place where he can meet other scientists. He can kind of exchange his knowledge. He also, there are all these, you know, fabulous engravers because he needs people to, you know, do the engravings for his publications. It's the publishing center, really, at that time, the scientific publishing center. And, you know, because of the French Revolution, basically, the role of the church really diminished. So for the first time, you have these scientists who are all allowed to ask these questions, which other scientists in other European countries are not allowed to ask. So this is the place to be as a scientist.
How does Napoleon feel about Humboldt?
So Napoleon is actually jealous of Humboldt, which I think is fabulous. He regards him with great suspicion for two reasons, I think. One is there is this... there's this Prussian scientist who rocks up in Paris. A couple of years later, France and Prussia are at war. So Napoleon is a little bit irritated. You know, for a long time thinks he's a spy. You know, what is he doing here? Why is he not living in Berlin? That's one thing. And the other thing is that Napoleon was really into the sciences. So it's a good time to be a scientist in Paris at that time. And he had, when he invaded Egypt, his army was accompanied by 200 scholars to collect all the knowledge that there was in Egypt, and all paid for by the French government. And they were publishing a book which was called The Description of Egypt, which would eventually have several volumes and, you know, about 1,000 engravings. And there was Humboldt, a private man, doing something more ambitious because he's doing something about the whole world. So his publication kind of reached more volumes, had more engravings. So Napoleon was just really annoyed with him, I think.
And yet, ironically, Bonpland ends up tending Josephine's garden.
Yes, but that is. But then, you know, by then, Napoleon and Josephine are also divorced. So
maybe not so ironic. So next, Humboldt he sets his sight on India. He wants to get to India, but he needs the approval of the British East India Tea Company, not the Crown, but the Tea Company.
The East India Company, exactly. They are so basically because Humboldt wants to understand the whole world. In order to complete his Naturgemälde of the whole world, he's done South America. He now needs to see Asia so he can compare. And he wants to climb the Himalaya. He wants to compare the Himalaya with the Andes. He wants to compare the different plants, the different climates. So he needs the permission of the East India Company, the British East India, who they are controlling pretty much the whole subcontinent. And he tries for about 20 years and he fails again and again and
Why?
Again. I think the reason is Humboldt was allowed to go to South America by the Spanish king. These are all Spanish colonies at the time when he's traveling there. He comes back and he publishes these books in which he criticizes the Spanish colonial rule in South America. So the British were not going to let this kind of very annoying Prussian scientist come to their colonies and then write books about how badly they treat the kind of, you know, the Indian people, for example.
Okay. We've got an email from Katie. She asks, why did Humboldt slip into obscurity? And you addressed that in part. But she also asks, did people in the environmental movement in the 1970s know about his ideas? And she says, thanks for this fascinating show. You're welcome, Katie.
Well, it's quite difficult to find out who knows about him and who doesn't. So there are people who have heard about him. There are people who write about him, but he did not have a huge impact on the environmental movement. So, for example, I'm pretty sure that Rachel Carson, for example, did not explicitly refer to Humboldt, but her entire idea in Silent Spring is really based on this idea that nature is an interconnected whole. So what I would argue is that a lot of ecologists, environmental writers, and campaigners today are still, you know, firmly rooted in Humboldt's vision of nature, although many have never heard of him.
Early on in the 20th century, John Muir was influenced by him. And Muir, as you write, was an environmentalist who helped to found the Sierra Club. And he actually took Humboldt's ideas a step further and advocated preservation.
So what was really amazing for me doing the research about this book is not just doing the research about Humboldt, but all the people he influenced. So, for example, Muir grew up reading Humboldt's books. And amazingly, Muir's copies of Humboldt's books still exist today in an archive in Stockton, California, where the Muir archives are. So they have Muir's library and Humboldt's books in there. And now if you open those books, they are heavily marked and annotated by Muir. He writes his own indexes to the book. So it's like listening to Muir having a conversation with Humboldt. And you can see what he did find interesting. So what I argue is that actually a lot of Muir's ideas on forest preservation actually come from Humboldt. So he underlines sentences where Humboldt describes the function of the forest for the ecosystem. The other thing that Muir takes from Humboldt is this idea that nature is an interconnected whole. So again, that's, you know, he takes that from Humboldt. The other thing is that Humboldt saw nature as a living organism. Again, that's something that Muir takes. And then, and I think that's incredibly important in Muir's case also, is this idea that you have to use your emotions and your imagination to understand nature. Because it really launches Muir into this deeply sensual relationship with nature, which for me jumps from every single page he writes. And then that's where he also takes it a step further. So he uses nature writing really as a campaign tool. He wants to make the Americans fall in love with nature so that they then go and protect nature.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention Darwin and his relationship with Humboldt.
Another big name, huh? So Darwin actually said that he would have not boarded the Beagle and therefore not conceived the Origin of Species without Humboldt.
That's something.
So they have, and again, amazingly, we still have Darwin's books, Humboldt books, which he took with him on the Beagle. He puts them on a shelf next to his hammock. And these books are still there. The books, the Humboldt books, which went with Darwin on the Beagle. And again, they're underlined, their comments written in the margins. And what we can see is that Humboldt influenced Darwin in, you know, there are several aspects to it. One is that he actually made Darwin go to South America. Then Darwin really uses Humboldt's books as a model for his own book. So The Voyage of the Beagle is very similar to Humboldt's personal narrative. And he uses Humboldt's books almost like as a source material when he's working on his evolutionary theory. Because Humboldt is also called by others as a pre-Darwinian Darwinist. So a lot of ideas on evolution and on you know, changing species are already in Humboldt's books. And also this idea that you have, you know, plant migration, why are there similar plants across different continents? And Darwin is fascinated by that. But that's a discipline, really, that Humboldt found. So there's all that. And then there's a fabulous moment where Darwin actually meets Humboldt. So for decades, this is like his hero. And Humboldt has reached this kind of mythical proportions in Darwin's mind. And then they meet in 1842 in London. By which time, so this is just after the Beagle, the return of the Beagle. And Humboldt is an old man by then. And very much used to being the attention. And he likes to ramble and he never stops talking. And Darwin is absolutely shocked because Humboldt just goes into this monologue and Darwin can't get a word in. So he's really disappointed about, you know, meeting the actual man.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right, we've got some more telephone calls. Jane in Bella Kynwood, you're on Radio Times. Welcome, Jane.
Yes, I wondered if the speaker is familiar with Saul Bellow's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Humboldt's Gift,
yes,
from the 1970s, and if she could comment on the use of Humboldt's feeling about materialistic America in that book.
Thanks, Jane.
I can't really, because I'm not a literary critic. But it's for me, it's just another case of how influential Humboldt was for kind of different people, in all, you know, from literary fiction to science and climate change.
So let's get back to Humboldt's travels. India is denied him. So as you mentioned early in their show, he ends up going to Russia. But from the get-go, this is a very different trip. It's financed by the Tsar, and certain things are expected from Humboldt.
Yeah, so by then he has completely run out of money. He spent his entire fortune on his Latin American exploration and on his books. So, but he's desperate to, you know, see some something about Asia. So he gets the Russian Tsar to pay for this expedition, but he's not allowed. So there are very clear instructions. He is not allowed to comment on the conditions of the people who live in Russia. And he is meant to look at lots of mines and to kind of see what kind of, you know, is there silver, gold, platinum in there. And he does that, but he also, you know, that's typical Humboldt. So he kind of goes from St. Petersburg and Moscow, meets all the kind of important people, and then he goes all the way through Siberia. And then he's meant to turn around. Well, he's in Siberia. No one is going to know, is it? So he just adds a detour of 2,500 miles.
2,500 miles.
To go to the Altai Mountains because he wants to see some, this is the Asian part of Russia, because he wants to see some Asian mountains.
And how old is he at this point?
60. So okay. He celebrates his 60th birthday, actually, there. And they travel day and night. So he uses more than 12,000 1,000 horses. So they change horses every 20 miles. So it's an extraordinary journey also.
And on the way, didn't they encounter an anthrax epidemic?
Yes, it's in a steppe in Siberia. And he's like, well, I don't care. I need to go to these mountains. So we're all going to sit, servants, you know, everybody's going to sit inside the carriage.
What did they see?
Well, they saw lots of dead animals. They saw all these fires at the entrances and exits of the villages, which were where they were like burning the animals. And they just raced for 5 days through the kind of anthrax infested steppe and made it.
It's amazing he made it to 89.
I know.
So Humboldt notes in his travels through Russia and Siberia that forests were rapidly disappearing around mining centers. And again, there was an environmental impact around agriculture. And again, this led to his prescient forecast of climate change.
Yeah. I mean, so I think this is the extraordinary thing, that he's so forward-looking, and he always tries to understand why is this happening. And he, you know, at some stage, he's so gloomy about the future of humankind that he says, you know, one day we will travel to distant planets and we're going to turn them barren, just as what we are doing with Earth.
Hmm. At this time, too, scientists were wrestling with the concept of God and creation. Could you get into that for us?
So Humboldt writes a book called Cosmos, which is about the universe, about Earth, about outer space, about kind of tiny flecks of moss. I mean, everything. So he writes a book about everything, 5 volumes, without ever mentioning God. So he never says God doesn't exist, but he is, as his brother Wilhelm said, he was never interested in religion. He avoids the subject. He is incredibly critical of the church, in particular of the missionaries, because he sees how they treat the native population in South America. So it's a subject he kind of avoids. And it's interesting to see then John Muir using so many of Humboldt's ideas, but he's adding the kind of the divine layer, because Muir sees nature as, you know, God's book, basically.
How was Cosmos received by the general scientific community?
Well, Cosmos was received by everybody with it was a huge success. Scientists absolutely adored it. Writers adored it. Poets adored it. Walt Whitman wrote Leaves on Grass with a copy of Cosmos on his table. So it's a book that makes Humboldt famous across the world. It's a huge bestseller. It's the book that makes him really famous in the United States.
So he finishes his 5th volume of Cosmos, and then weakened by a stroke, he passes away. What was the reaction in Europe and America?
Everybody was absolutely devastated. So you have, they were just mourning him. And there's 10 years after his death, in 1869, it's the centennial of his birth, and there are celebrations across the world, like Moscow, Buenos Aires, Mexico City, Berlin, America. In Manhattan, 25,000 people marched through the streets in his honor. You have huge celebrations, Philadelphia, for example. You have these kind of a mile-long march through the cities. You have the dignitaries of the city giving speeches. Everybody celebrates him.
And on that note, we have to wrap it up. Andrea Wolf, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea is author of The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And she will be speaking tonight at the American Philosophical Society at the Benjamin Franklin Hall, 427 Chestnut Street in Philly. And that is from 6 until 7 o'clock. And remember to visit our Facebook page and podcasts. You can find them at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And Diana Allen is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.